This podcast is brought to you by Sky Arts, proud broadcast sponsor of the Guardian Hay Festival, bringing you the book show at Hay every day at 7 p.m. on Sky Arts One HD with me, Mariella Frostrup. For details, visit sky.com/arts.
Oh, I love the smell of fresh coffee. Let's get a spoon and stir that up. Okay, we're on a campsite called Radnor's End, which is at the top of the first hill after you pass the river. Where's our ticket? Oh, it's in my folder. Summer 2010 booking. Because there's so many, what I've done is put them all into a folder, into envelopes. I quite enjoy being organised. I like to know that I've got everything in one place, that I'm not going to lose the tickets, because there's a lot of money here. My husband is going to Christopher Andrews, who's Ed Byrne, Niall Ferguson, Paul Murden, finishing with Ross Noble. You probably need to top up the coffee, dear. Definitely we save money, and this campsite, incredible value for money. With the electric, it was only £12.50 a night. So £150 for the time we're here. I've actually written on the back of our invoice various comments. What did I write here? Oh yes, we went to see Roddy Doyle a couple of days ago. So we've been talking value for money. He was the first £9 ticket we went to. He was so good. I'm going to go and buy some of his books. Get the tickets out for today. Then I'll go in my rucksack and get my helmet on soon. I'll be off on my trusty bike to see the first event.
I'm John Harris and I'm here with Professor James Lovelock in a lovely hotel in Kington, which is about 20 minutes drive from Hay. Professor Lovelock is attending the festival this weekend to give what amounts to his final warning to humankind. Professor Lovelock is, of course, responsible for the theory of Gaia, which puts forward the idea that the Earth is a living and evolving organism, and it's a theory which lives and evolves itself. His latest book, The Vanishing Face of Gaia, is the seventh of his books on the Gaia hypothesis, and in it he tells us that our supposed efforts to save the planet are having precious little effect. Gaia theory and what it entails is a hypothesis which, what, is about 40 years old? In terms of sort of alerting people to it, convincing people of it, how much progress do you think you've made, and how much more have you got to do, do you think?
Well, I don't think I can do it. I think it'll be successors who'll have to do it, because we're not really clever enough yet as a species. We haven't evolved far enough. The Earth's evolving all right, and we're evolving with it. But it's a damn slow process. It's taken a million years to change from being kind of semi-intelligent animals in the jungle to what we are now. Still animals and still semi-intelligent. Only a bit more intelligent than we were then. And I don't think we can handle big problems like the Earth.
Are we awaiting a kind of breakthrough moment where, probably via some catastrophic turn of events, that will suddenly kick in the kind of awareness and intelligence, as you put it, that's required?
It'd be wonderful if that happened, but I just can't see it.
Well, if it did, what kind of event would it be?
Oh, I don't think it works like that. You see, in the last million years, there have been seven major climate shifts. And the world's temperature rose over 5 degrees. In one case, it looked as if it rose nearly 10 degrees. And humans have been through that. Geneticists estimate that at one of those great disasters, we were cut down in numbers to only between 2 and 5,000. So it's that kind of event that kind of sorts the mind out.
And the time frame we're looking at, I mean, when will it become clear?
That's the rub. The time it'll take, we also don't know. It could take as long as 1,000 years. I don't think it'll take that long, but it could do. We're now beginning to realise what we don't know, which is always the way of scientific progress.
Climate science, is written about hugely. It's discussed by people who very often know precious little about it, and it's highly charged because it's so political, right? What does that do to it as a scientific, as a branch of science and a scientific discipline, if you like?
Not a lot of good on the whole.
No kidding.
But no. But don't get too miserable or feel guilty about it. Think of it the other way round. The climate scientists are at the sharp end. Who else but the weather forecaster has to come up every day before the public and state what he thinks tomorrow's weather's going to be like? And if he makes a real boom, like that poor guy did who missed the hurricane, he's in for dead trouble. Now, most scientists never confront the public at all. They just work quietly in their labs and they do their experiments. Nobody hears a damn thing about them until they make some poison that kills off some half a dozen people or something like that.
What your point there being that it cuts both ways, that it's good to be so in the public eye as far as climate scientists are concerned, but it also has its drawback.
That's right.
And I mean, I guess an example of that, about how sort of perilous climate science can be, was so-called climate change and the huge controversy around what came out of the University of East Anglia recently, which seemed in the public mind to then call the entire climate change hypothesis into question. Do you agree with that? Is that a bad thing if it's happened, from your perspective?
No, not a bit. Indeed, if you read my book, it was inspired by the IPCC report in 2007, where the leader talked about a consensus among scientists. Well, immediately I heard that, I thought, bullshit. This is absolute rubbish. You can't have a consensus about a thing like that. You have viewed a group of different views, but one of them's going to be right, or none of them right, and the rest wrong.
But if suddenly that feeling of scepticism is all the greater, the standard issue sort of green response to that is to wring your hands and say, oh, what a terrible thing. This is going to set back the cause decades. But you don't necessarily believe in the cause.
Well, I
agree. So is it a problem that people are more sceptical now than they were?
No, they're not. They're just being sensible. It's a matter of perception, really. The facts are, although the climate scientists have been a bit derelict, not the ones at East Anglia, I might add, but climate scientists generally, in stating the fact the world's temperature has not changed a jot to speak of since 1998. For over 10 years, 12 years now, the temperature has been more or less steady. If anything, they're beginning to drop slightly at the moment.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, to clarify your position on some of this, which really informs everything that you're saying, you believe in the reality of man-made climate change?
Yes. I believe is a very strong word. It's a word
evidence,
religion.
The evidence suggests, But having said that, the idea that we can have a man-made response to it which is effective is increasingly delusional.
I think so. I don't think we've a chance in hell of answering climate change. We'll do our best and it'll be good for us. And I think our best is simply to cut back on waste.
What should politicians, in terms of leadership, be actually doing? What should they be proposing?
It's a bloody awful job as being a politician. It doesn't matter what party you stand for or what government is in. Why don't they just say, right, we'll have nuclear energy and then they won't put any CO2 out. We'll be like France. And the electricity bills have dropped to about half.
And sort of waste management and reducing waste. I mean, give me an instant and potentially popular move you could make on that would begin to address the problem.
A few carrots and sticks would help a lot. I'll give you a classic, stupid example. In the supermarket, they offer you the choice, some of them, of a paper bag or a plastic bag. And the Greens, of course, choose the paper bag. If they don't know that paper bag is 50 times more polluting than the plastic bag. You see, if there's one way you want to get rid of carbon, stop putting CO2 in the air, instead of burning the petroleum products, you turn them into plastics because they finish up on a landfill somewhere and they last there underground virtually forever, whereas the paper bag oxidizes when the bugs get at it in no time at all, and up it goes the CO2.
You sound confident that if you were to return to Earth 2,000 or 3,000 years hence, there would still be human beings there.
I'm fairly confident. We're a very tough species.
But there might only be 5,000 of us.
I hope not, because that's cutting it down too far, really. It's getting chancy as to whether we survive at all.
In the introduction to the book, you talk about the fact that Richard Branson has pretty much guaranteed you a trip into space. That's right, isn't it? When are you going?
And he means what he says.
When are you going?
I wish I knew, but hopefully by either the end of this year or early next year. It had better be soon because I'm aging and the damn medicals may say, oh, he's not fit enough to go into space.
How do you feel looking forward to that prospect?
With great excitement. What a choice, I mean, to live this long and then have the chance of seeing that. So I really hope it comes off.
Keep coming, please. Keep moving. We want to get you in on time. We're 2 minutes late.
I'm Tobias Hill. This is the Summer House at the Hay Festival, where we're holding the Faber Academy this year. The Faber Academy is a creative writing programme. Sunny day today. The students are out in the garden having their lunch at the moment. If I had to give some advice on writing, I would say turn off the mobile, turn off the broadband, and read.
As you've been hearing in our podcasts over the last few days, politicians, scientists, ecologists and commentators are always drawn to the Hay Festival, keen to show off their intellectual side. But Hay is, of course, a festival of books. And as the weekend rush subsides, the programme returns to a more literary feel.
That's right, and one of the highlights has been Jeanette Winterson's talk on the 25th anniversary of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. She talked for an hour about the background to the novel and, as we'll hear now, described how her course in life was set after an incident in her mid-teens with her adoptive mother.
I fell in love with a girl when I was 16. Or so well, I was 14, actually, but I finally decided I had to leave her and there was lots of to-ing and fro-ing. And so I was there and she said, look, you know, you either give up the girl or you leave home. So what could I do? I had to leave home. There was no real choice for me because I didn't want to give something up that I loved. I didn't want to give something up that made me happy. And indeed, that's what she asked me. So I packed my bag. I didn't have much stuff. And I was going down the gloomy old hall. She called me back and I thought, oh, maybe she'll change her mind because I was sad. And she said, Jeanette. I said, yeah, go on, what? She said, you say this makes you happy. And I said, yeah, it does, Mum. It does. And she said, why be happy when you could be normal? Do you know, I've never stopped thinking about that.
Just imagine how different the course of 20th century literature would be had Jeanette Winterson opted to be normal.
Quite right, and you can see more of her in a video on our Hay website, along with all the usual blogs, news, reviews and Twitter updates. It's all at guardian.co.uk/hay.
Now, I appeared with Andrea Levy, best known as the author of the Orange Prize-winning novel Small Island. She was actually here to talk about her new book, The Long Song, which is a Jamaican story set in the last years of slavery and the early years of freedom.
With this sort of subject, we have nothing. We have 300 years of slavery. We have practically no information about the enslaved people. Not really, not a great deal. We don't even have births, deaths, marriages, you know, nothing. And so fiction has to step in. Fiction has to sort of say, well, perhaps it was like this, and has to give you the humanity of those people. That's what's very important to me, that these weren't, as I keep saying, they weren't people uniquely created to be slaves. They were you and me. How would you feel if you had to manure a cane field? That is, you had to go get yourself a wicker basket. This was woman's work. This is women's work. And you go to the droppings house. You fill it up with droppings that fall from the backside of a mule. You put it on your head and you walk maybe 2-3 miles to a cane piece, a cane field, and you pad this all around the base of the canes, and then you go back and you do it again. This is your day's work. And this stuff on their head would sort of ooze brown, that would sort of drip, and they would have to eat their food with this thing on their head. And, you know, and I'm reading this and thinking, and this is human beings that went through this. You know, we are not talking about cattle. We're talking about you or me, and it would have been pretty smelly time.
David Mitchell's known for tackling history in a slightly different way, and earlier this week he was here for the Guardian Book Club discussion of his third novel, Cloud Atlas, and you'll be able to hear the whole of that on the site soon.
But before that, Richard Lee got a chance to speak to him about his latest book, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. The story's set in Nagasaki in 1799 at a Dutch trading post, which is Japan's only contact with Europe. So Richard started by asking him what the inspiration for the book was.
The idea came from stumbling over, quite literally, the same said Dutch East Indies Company trading post in Nagasaki. I was there in 1994 and got off the wrong tram and found a museum, some old warehouses. And this was long before I was a writer or a published writer, but I sort of took the seed of it away with me. And you know, if I couldn't make some kind of a halfway decent novel out of just that singular world, then I wouldn't be much of a novelist.
What's the appeal of that particular setting?
A pretty unique kind of cultural cat flap between Japan, which was then rather like North Korea is now, which is just this hermit state, no way in, but actually much more so than North Korea is now, in a way that there was no smuggled out YouTube footage, there was nothing except what came through Dejima. All of the 18th century, the Enlightenment, the texts leaked into Japan through Dejima. Also, the white Europeans were the virtual prisoners, and very much the terms were dictated to them and not the other way around. They weren't allowed to leave this tiny man-made walled island in Nagasaki Bay, and the only people allowed on were merchants and the hereditary interpreters and very, very expensive prostitutes. The Japanese knew a captive audience, a captive market when they saw one.
So it was both the way of viewing the Enlightenment through Japanese eyes and also the kind of petri dish nature of this particular...
Exactly. Walls and islands are very good news for fiction because there's no way off them. And so human neuroses can't sort of go through the exit door when the going gets tough. They have to sort of bloom and bear fruit.
Was the fact that the protagonists, the colonial protagonists, were Dutch, was that an added attraction? It's like a different angle on the colonial experience for a British audience.
At the time, it was an added nuisance because I didn't know much about the Netherlands and had to go and live there for a few months. But yes, retrospectively, our colonial literature, mostly, obviously, would be versions of Forster's A Passage to India. It's the English colonial experience, and it's quite interesting to see the differences. And it also gives me an opportunity for the English to kind of come sailing in on a frigate in book three. We get to see Nagasaki through the English eyes. I mean, they don't know what they're blundering into, a little bit like the reader at the beginning of my book.
How much were you in pursuit of an accurate portrait of the time, of the ways of thinking, and how much were you driven by the story?
Well, that's exactly the problem. It's in the genre's name, historical fiction. It has to be historical enough for you to feel the past in your ribcage as you read. But if it's too historical, then you run into trouble because you end up writing history and your plot will be prescribed by events that actually happened.
Well, you moved your frigate a few years earlier to have it arrive with slightly more drama. Obviously, you're taking some liberties with the facts and when the facts happen. But yeah. Was the mindset something you were particularly keen to explore accurately?
Yeah, the mindset has to be kept. The major events have to be kept. I mean, once you start playing around with the dates of the Napoleonic Wars itself, then you're into alternate history, which is another genre altogether. What I did do was, for example, change the name of the frigate, the British frigate, from HMS Phaeton to actually HM Frigate Phoebus, to be technically accurate. Otherwise, I would have had to have kept my cast sort of hanging around in a sort of archers-like stasis for 8 years. That's bad news for fiction. In an earlier draft, I sort of did do that, but ran into trouble precisely because I'd got the balance between historical and fiction wrong.
The book is shot through with miscomprehensions and incomprehensions, the misunderstandings across the borders of language and physical separation. Is that something of your experience of living in Japan yourself?
Oh, just a bit. Have you ever tried living abroad?
I was in France for a little bit, but that's a little bit different, I guess.
Somewhat, but on the other hand, you must have had your own struggles with the language.
Absolutely, yeah. I went there not speaking really a word.
Then you know what it's like. And anyone who's been in that situation, it's sort of, it's best epitomised by Manuel's Immortal.
Okay.
Then I realised, actually, no, kind of, this is a great opportunity. You're not exploiting. No, they wouldn't have understood one another very well. Use it. I have a theory that any given writer is a sort of walking bundle of archetypal themes that always pop up in his or her books, even when the writer doesn't really want them there. Like one of mine, in the form of stammering in Black Swan Green, it's actually the same theme. It's where there's a big, ugly discrepancy between your ability to produce language in your head and then your ability to produce language out of your mouth. I come back to that again and again, it seems, and here I am doing it again.
There's a clear trajectory from your elaborate structures of ghostwritten Cloud Atlas towards the more straightforward lines of Black Swan Green and The Thousand Autumns. Is that formal experimentation that you were doing 10 years ago? Is that a young man's game?
Possibly. I'm a dad, and I've been a husband for a good few years now, and human mud is becoming more interesting to me and sort of becoming richer compost. First two, three books, there's, for example, not one sort of really deeply explored mother or father stroke son-daughter relationship there. Sort of in a sense, they're very clean. Murakami would be the sort of, I think, the most hygienic author who's ever been published in this respect. There's not a speck of sort of emotional human mud in his books, and I like them very much. But for me now, I think it would be fair to say that much more of my interest has shifted into, yeah, sort of just the mess we get into. Another fine mess you've got me into.
What are you working on at the moment?
A very muddy book. although, you know, I'm sort of, you don't throw structure out of the window either. This looks like a straightforward thing, but it's got its architecture. It's got 13 chapters per book. It's all in the third person, but it's kind of first person, really. We've got a prologue for each of the three books told by someone who then isn't the narrator of the rest of it. Book one has one narrative viewpoint. It's like a one-stroke engine, and it sort of walks. It walks. Book two has two narrative viewpoints that trots, and book three has three narrative viewpoints. That's a run. So you don't throw structure out of the window, but it's very much the case that structures, for me, is now sort of the servant of the human mud rather than the other way around.
I've actually read all of David Mitchell's books apart from this one, so I'm really looking forward to picking that up in the Hay Festival bookshop later on. Now, tomorrow's Haycast is looking at Hay Fever, the children's side of the festival. We'll be hearing from Mal Peet, the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize winner, among others, and Jartin Poskett will be setting us a murderous math test.
Oh, so, dear, that's, yes, not my strong suit.
Calculators at the ready.